irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Dave's Good Vibration Station with Dave Cohen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Vibration Station, right here on LATalkRadio.com, world's most listened to internet talk radio station. Collective vibrational raising. How's everybody doing on this beautiful Sunday? You've just tuned in to Dave's Good Vibration Station with your host, Davey. We have a very, very special show lined up for you today. Now, first and foremost, as you know, here on the Vibration Station, we inspire truly anything and everything to raise your vibration. Now, this is why we bring on such amazing people. Like, we have the honor of bringing on today Vibration Station regular. We can welcome Bruce Rawls, author, founder of GeometryCode.com. You guys got to check him out. Welcome to the show, Bruce. Such a pleasure to have you. It always is.
Well, thank you, David, for having me on your show again. Well, it's a privilege and a pleasure.
You are so amazing, and the listeners, you all know, just another session with Bruce. All the listeners love you, Bruce. I love you. We're all just so digging the enlightenment and the fascinating truth, like information that you bring to the surface of our consciousness. So we can explore the facets of what we never thought was possible before listening to you. So I really, really appreciate that, Bruce. It's very true. It's very true. We learn many, many things when we have the privilege of having you on the show. So it's always an honor. So
thanks. Hope I can live up to that.
Yeah. Well, you always say that, and you always exceed our expectations. So it is. I'm sure we're in for another treat. Last on the show, Bruce, we were talking about some super fascinating, proven mathematical experiences proven mathematical equations that are existing in our universe, in our galaxies. We got a couple emails from listeners saying how they thought that it was extremely fascinating how Jupiter and Earth shared a volcanic activity, that one line of volcanic activity in the same coordinates. Am I correct? The same coordinates?
Very close. It's actually Jupiter's moon Io that has a volcanic activity.
The moon Io. Yes. Indeed. Yeah. People found that to be very, very fascinating. And I personally as well found it to be really interesting as to how that can be, right? So it's just like it's stuff like this that just makes me question, like, the perfect alignment between planets, between galaxies. Like, everything is so interconnected, from the very little microcosm cell to like, you know, to the huge, you know, universe galaxies that are constantly expanding and growing apart from each other into whatever we know is expanding into nothingness, moreness. I don't even know what I'm saying. It's crazy. But that's just like it's literally bending, you know, what we know as human beings, and if we can extend our knowledge and our understanding of, you know, sacred geometry and its relationship with the planets, with the human body, with the galaxies, I mean, we will find, as you've proved to us, that everything is truly interconnected. So, very, very interesting stuff. Very, very interesting.
It is. It is. It's fascinating for me for many decades. And I think that the interconnectedness really is a symbolic reminder of the intrinsic unity that we all have.
Yes.
And because oneness is such a boggling concept, that, you know, we're so geared toward our personal selves and to the identity that claims to be, you know, that I have an identity separate from you and everyone else and vice versa. And
right.
and it's just such a pervasive thought system that we don't even really think that there's an option.
Exactly.
Most of the time, it's just like asking a fish about water. You know, it's like, well, what's that? You know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
It's one of those unchallenged assumptions. And so, I think interconnectedness, and shared interests, and things that dissolve the illusion of separation,
yes,
are all helpful metaphors and symbolic constructs that can remind us that the interconnectedness leads to an intrinsic oneness that really is at the heart of any kind of spiritual inquiry.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's said beautifully, Bruce. Literally, you're such a linguist. Truly, truly said beautifully.
Well, it just seems like that we've all tried the approach, you know, the sort of been there, done that, with the, you know, everybody for themselves approach to life.
Yes.
And I think whenever we fall back on that, we realize it's not working.
It does not work. It does not work.
You know, because when we basically bypass kindness and that kind of deep relatedness,
yes,
that really is at the heart of compassion and really caring for each other without exception, and not saying, well, this group over there, well, I'll you know, they're not in my heart today,
right?
But all these other people are.
Exactly,
you know,
like conditional loving, conditional,
yeah,
appreciation.
Yeah, exactly. And when you preface your show with, you know, the love, and I was thinking, well, that really is such an important, well, it really is the fundamental quality of what really is life.
It is.
And yet we exclude it and separate ourselves off by identifying with the separate interests and the things that symbolize our isolation.
Wow.
So I think, and just like anything else, geometry and any other study can be used as a tool,
yes,
that either brings us together or pushes us apart.
Absolutely.
And what we talked about the last time I was on your program was the seven hermetic laws and how
– Indeed.
I won't go through those all again, but I think the first one is real important because it really ties into what Plato, I think,
yes,
who is credited with naming at least the five Platonic saws that we talked about in the first show and continued on in the second one, is the mind is primary. And this first hermetic law, which really if you get this one, you almost don't need the other six, is that everything really exists in our thoughts.
Yes.
And modern physics bears this out. And this dream of a cosmos that we made up is really a mental construction.
It's huge. It's so fascinating to me that we're in this, you know, we're in 2014 coming into 2015. If you look at where we were in technology, in you know, modern day physics, in what the, you know, collective belief about you know, what was capable of moving time and space, you know, certain, you know, you're in the three-dimensional world, and I mean, to make that quantum leap into understanding that nothing is exterior, that truly it is a full internal projection of what you are vibrationally outputting. It's just like, you know, the classic example of the radio dial. You know, you can't be tuned essentially to you can't be emitting. Being like, you can't be so angry and saying, you know, oh, I don't like these people or I like these people, just like you were explaining, Bruce. You can't be a conditional, appreciator or sifter, you know, and simultaneously hold the vibration of unconditional love and infinite knowledge of, you know, expanding into a greater knowing of love and a greater knowing of compassion. Like, you know, they do not exist. Poverty and abundance are two opposite vibrations, you know. Like, it's like,
exactly.
if you want to listen to, you know, here in Los Angeles, if you want to listen to classic rock, you're going to tune to 95.5 KLOS, you know. But if you tune to K-Earth 101 classics, you know, don't, it's like people tune to K-Earth 101 and they complain that they're like not listening to rock and roll. That's like, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, tune your dial to 95.5 and it has to come. So sorry for that tangent. I just
a weaving in of a geometric term, by the way.
Yeah, thank you.
But, which kind of reminds me of, I have a lot of fun on Facebook, and somebody posted a picture of a 50s retro picture of a woman and her daughter sitting on her knee, kind of thing.
Okay.
And the girl asked, "Mommy, what's normal?" and the mother says, "Oh, it's a setting on the dryer, honey." and so my somewhat smart alecky response back when I posted it, shared it, was, "I thought normal meant perpendicular," because I was
yeah, exactly. That's
thinking
funny.
As a geometer.
Yes,
but we can use, but to get back to your more inspired discussion, which was that was sort of a silly tangent.
No, I love it.
It really is incumbent upon us to just look gently at all the ways that we use the symbols of our lives,
yes.
Which really is we really are all symbols for each other. We're all walking metaphors,
yes.
For what's in our minds. And if we can look gently and kindly on those things and recognize that they're projections of what's inside of us, maybe on an unconscious level and probably mostly on an unconscious level,
right.
Then we get the opportunity to heal our opinion of ourselves, our estimation of ourselves,
exactly.
At every moment by looking at those things that annoy us, irritate us, and just generally piss us off.
Yeah.
And say, oh, this is something that I've brought up for myself, which is really, we can afford to be grateful and say, oh, now I have the opportunity to heal the schism, to unfragment, to defractalize, if you will,
yes.
This branching out that I did on some level that now I can reconcile. So,
wow. No, absolutely. I mean, that's I yeah, that's absolutely amazing, and it's so true. What it reminds me of, this popped in my head, and I wanted to relate this before I forgot. Earlier, how you were saying, you know, we can try to play the game of separation, right? This is essentially what this topic is about. I mean, connection. Mm-hmm. We are all one. We, you know, so this story has always resonated very deeply with me since I've heard it. Are you familiar with the story of Christopher McCandless, or he changed his name to Alexander Supertramp? The book Into the Wild. There was also a movie about it. Are you familiar at all with that, Bruce?
You know, I've heard the name. I actually have met Roger Hodgson and heard him in concert a couple times when I lived in Nevada City, California, where he has a studio. And he's a former, lead singer of the band Supertramp. But that's probably not who you're referring to. But the other name I have heard as well. But I'm not just familiar with.
No. Yes. Yeah. So basically, this man, he was top of his class, college graduate, scholar. Basically, he had a rough home life, decides to pack everything up and leave for Alaska. He thinks that humans, that basically the human race is a cancer, right? And I think that I think that we've briefly spoken about how people have this skewed perception of the human race. And basically, Alexander Supertramp, he packs his bags and hitchhikes, ends up in Alaska, ends up living in this, worn down bus in Alaska.
Was there a movie made about him?
Yes, there was.
Okay, I saw the movie then.
Oh,
okay,
perfect.
This sounds really familiar.
Into the Wild. Yes. With, Oh, I'm blanking on his name, but that younger actor that there was a movie. So long story short, one of the last sentences that he ever wrote, and this is true, Bruce. This is actually the one of the last sentences that they've ever found, written in his journal, was, "Nothing is real if not shared." Now, here's a man that thought that, the human race was this cancer and just consuming everything and, essentially animalistic, right? But mm-hmm. he, had kind of a rough home life and just wanted to get away and wanted to live off the land, wanted to be a self-sustainable individual and not associate with the, cancerous human society. Well, little to his, knowledge at the time, would his last words be, "Nothing is real if not shared"? And I think that experiences like that, Bruce, just go to show us that, as much as we try to convince ourselves that we are meant to be alone, or that, that people are bad and their intentions aren't good, or whatever excuses or whatever experiences you may have had in your life to come up with, justifications for thinking of anything outside of the light or, alignment or goodness or love, as we were talking about, loops us back around to knowing that we need one another. There is no expanding. There is no, experiencing anything more than, I don't know how to properly say it, but it's just you. It resonates with exactly what we're talking about here. Is you need connection. You need the human touch. You need love. You need affection. You need compassion. You need to bounce off of someone else. You can't just run away from people and think that they're bad. And I don't know. I just feel like in this world, with everything that's going on, the wars and the conflicts with the terrorist groups and whatever, and I obviously, understanding vibration, do my very best not to think about it and put negative energy into it. If anything, I pray for the people and think of alignment for them. But it's just like, people need to know love, Bruce. People need to know how interconnected we all are, and we would not be killing one another. We would be loving and hugging and sharing and creating North American unions and I don't know. So I'm sorry. Please take.
Actually, that reminds me of a movie that if you haven't seen or your listeners haven't watched, is a wonderful film. While you were talking, which was very right on, by the way, I Googled Into the Wild, and I came up with awesome. Emil Hirsch as the actor that played Chris McCandless. That sound right?
You're perfect. Okay. You're okay. The man.
Anyway, the movie that I was referring to is actually very timely for this time of year. And there's a folk singer who I also heard named John McCutcheon, who frequents the college and small cultural enclave type community circuit around the country.
Oh, that's awesome.
Has for years.
That's really awesome. That's
anyway, he has a song called "Christmas in the Trenches" that's about this story, which a movie was also made out of. Wow. And the movie is "Merry Christmas," but it's the French title is "Joyeux Noël." I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but if you look up, let me go to my Facebook page. I can spell it properly because I have it listed as one of my favorite movies there.
That's awesome.
But what it's about is a ceasefire that happened on Christmas Day, or maybe it was Christmas Eve, when there was soldiers from Scotland, I believe, and France and Germany were all in the trenches. and fighting, and it was like, you know, they'd been fighting for weeks,
right?
And they were within earshot of each other, and at one point in the evening, someone started, you know, singing or whistling or whatever they were doing, Silent Night.
Wow.
And so wafting over the barbed wire, there was an echo of the chorus in harmony with them. And I think they all kind of looked at each other like, what the hell are we doing fighting this
yeah,
for?
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful movie. And
that gave me chills, Bruce. That gave me chills.
It really is that kind of a movie. I had a tremendous emotional impact on me, and it does every time I even think about it, because it's just such a profound metaphor for the battle that we're all waging against ourselves.
Yes.
And what the point you're raising is that in order for us to go beyond the totally insane thought system that we all have, and it would be silly to deny that, because our egos are insane. But I think the point you were making, and wisely so, was that what we really want to look at, what we really want to work back toward, is the awareness that we are all interconnected. And we can do that, actually, ironically, by looking at the craziness and seeing that it's just it doesn't make any sense.
It's
but we
so
have to
true.
Look at it. We have to gently look at it, see that it's insane, and choose against it.
I think
that's how we go beyond the craziness in our world and in our personal world. I mean, because it's not just like, you know, the battles of drones and boots on the ground and chemical warfare and all the stuff that makes the headline news. It's everyday stuff of when you argue with your housemates or have grudges or resentments against coworkers. I mean,
that's
the whole gamut of stuff. It's demonizing people that work in corporations because they are maybe not effective in overcoming the financial inertia that puts profits over health or safety or, you know. I mean, there's so many things that you could look at that have to do with the opposite of interconnectedness. And if we can look at those things, and it doesn't mean that we don't do the things that we can do, you know, if we're inspired to be an environmental or a social activist or, you know, do something ecologically that makes sense or culturally, you know, to bring communities together or nations or whatever. I mean, it would be silly not to do those things. But
exactly.
To remember that it's all in our mind and it's really each one of us individually has a responsibility to look at the contents of our mind and an opportunity, really. I mean, it's a glorious opportunity that we have to look at that and recognize that we can either be like the soldiers that in this wonderful movie, which I was about to find here, let me see if I get the spelling of it.
Oh, perfect! No, I'm definitely looking that one up tonight. We're gonna
it's a great one to put on your Netflix list or whatever.
That's
it's just a really wonderful movie. Let me see, here it is. Okay, yeah, it's J O Y E U X Noel.
Perfect.
Which is basically, I think it's French for Merry Christmas. You know, happy. Join Noel.
Right.
You know, it's not a kids movie or anything, but it's one that basically has, I think, a tremendous message that there is interconnectedness, and that the symbols that we look at every day, moment to moment, either remind us of that relationship that we have to everything, and you know, flatten the gap, if you will, or, you know, make the quantum connection that dissolves the belief in separation. Or if we choose that insane thought system, again, that we all have, it's always 100% full-blown crazy, then we're just postponing the inevitable communion back to source.
So true.
That we all can share with each other.
So true. That was said so beautifully. Man, I mean, you see, I've read these books, and they talk about all these different possibilities of this, you know, reawakening of, you know, source within, you know, each and every individual that is open to it, right? And then this possibilities of either, you know, some, you know, smarter extraterrestrial force, you know, coming down and showing us some gnarly understanding about the universe or like technology that will just, you know, warp like literally everything that human beings have ever known. And they're just, there's just like a violent shove into like, okay, you know, we've been wrong and we can correct this now, you know, or like whatever may happen, you know, just like whatever is going to happen. Like, I truly, truly believe that there is, you know, something right around the corner, or it's already happening. You know, it's been happening. This collective understanding of, I guess maybe more than an understanding, and asking, like a collective asking for a reunion, you know, back with the source within us, mm-hmm. outside of us, that is proven in mathematics. I mean, it's not about a belief system or like a religion. Right. It's about a mathematical breakdown. This is us. This is why we're here. We're here to expand into a greater more. We're here because we're source, because we're energy, because we can be, because we're potential. There is this yearning for inspiration in our hearts, in our DNA, that expands us into knowing more, into being more. It's just like, it's all about love. It's all about feeling that love and feeling more love and finding, you know, things out about yourself that you never even knew. And you know, it's just, I mean, you could go on forever about the universal, you know, expansion of source within the human essence. But I mean, it's truly, Bruce, it is, you know, it proves the existence of love and light and the interconnectedness. It's beautiful.
It is true. And I think we're to use another metaphor, I think it's not unlike that we're in a massive dream state. And that's why movies like Inception, for example, I think are wonderful, because when I first saw that film a few years ago, and I just recently watched it again, having bought the DVD, I liked it so much.
great movie.
I realized after I walked out of the theater, and for those who haven't seen it, it's about different levels of dreaming. I mean, that's a very, very, you know, rough and,
totally.
And oversimplified spoiler alert for what the film's about. But what I realized when I walked out of the theater, having seen that film for the first time, it's like, oh, now I'm just back to one level of dreaming.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because once I started watching the movie, I was at least at the second level. But I think that the dream metaphor is such an excellent one, because we make a distinction between nighttime dreams and daytime dreams, because we think that these daytime ones are so much more vivid, and we can describe things like polyhedra and skyscrapers and geopolitical boundaries and you know, DNA molecule geometries and you know, whatever else we want to talk about.
Exactly.
I mean, you could you know, pick any topic under the sun that has to do with our everyday space-time, you know, persona awareness of things. But we think this is the real deal. But there's a lot of metaphysical traditions, and I think modern physics really suggests that maybe, well, modern physics sort of hints at it and kind of points in that direction,
right,
more than some of the metaphysical traditions,
right,
and mystical traditions. But maybe what we're experiencing now is like a massive dream.
Yeah.
And there's that scene in Inception where Leonardo DiCaprio's character is talking to Ellen Page's character, and they're sitting in this French cafe, you know, outside this French cafe, and he asks her, well, do you remember how we got here?
Right. Oh my God.
Which I think is like a pivotal scene in the movie. It's like, well, no, and that's when the crazy things start happening.
Right.
You know, windows start blowing out, and all the special effects stuff kicks in.
Exactly.
But it's—I think it's a good metaphor. It's like, well, we're so entrenched.
It really is.
In the belief in separation that we've forgotten how we got here.
It really is. So
I think the only way to unforget and to remember is really to do things that collapse the separation. And I think that's where the geometric metaphors can be helpful. And when you called to check about the doing the show today, an hour or two ago, we talked about maybe talking about the Great Pyramid, because I could easily talk for another half hour.
Exactly.
That's actually a pretty interesting symbol that it encompasses a lot of things in a geometric form. So maybe we could talk some about that. Does that sound good?
Yeah, I was going to say I wanted to make a transition at some point into being able to expand on the Great Pyramid, because there's been a couple shows where we have just you and I, Bruce, where we resonate, those kindred spirits start going off, and we'll mean to talk about something, and then we'll just get on a tangent of talking about something super awesome, and then all of a sudden we've gone through a time continuum and it's 150. But yes, please, I would love to hear, especially with you having such a close relationship with the Great Pyramid, with you.
Well, I was fascinated with it ever since in the early 70s. My mom got me this book, which I pulled out of the bookcase. It's the cover's a bit tattered right now. I've taken it a number of times together. Still mostly falling apart. But anyway, I flipped open to page 49 of an early edition of Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins. And this book really just lit a fire under me in terms of, not just metaphysics, but also just like, well, we're not getting the whole story here,
right,
in our culture. So one of the famous people that visited the Great Pyramid was a gentleman named Napoleon.
Wow.
There were lots of people who studied it and measured the dimensions, but I'll just start with this, which is because it's an interesting anecdote. So anyway, I'm going to read from the middle of page 49.
Wow.
Because actually Napoleon commissioned a bunch of cartographers and artisans to draw all the stuff up and down the Nile, and they actually used, unfortunately, the Great Sphinx as a target practice for their cannons. So that's why it's –
oh, my gosh.
It's actually a little bit more beat up than it was a couple centuries ago.
No way.
Yes,
way. I did not know that.
Poor Sphinxy. He got to hammer.
He was the test dummy over there.
Really.
That's a terrible test dummy.
So we have Napoleon's army to thank for that.
Yeah, great job, Napoleon.
A little more prestige. When we go visit it, but not so much now. But anyway, but this is an interesting story. It says, meanwhile, Napoleon, whose logistical mind enabled him to figure out that the Great Pyramid and its Giza neighbors contained enough stone to build a wall 3 meters high and 1 meter thick all around France. That's a lot of rock.
That is a
slap attracted by the arcane qualities of the king's chamber.
Okay.
On the 25th of the Thermidor, the revolutionaries, August 1799, the general-in-chief visited the pyramid with the Imam Muhammad as his guide. At a certain point, Bonaparte asked to be left alone in the king's chamber, as Alexander the Great was reported to have done before him. Coming out, the general is said to have been very pale and impressed.
Wow.
When an aide asked him in a jocular tone if he had witnessed anything mysterious, Bonaparte replied abruptly that he had no comment, adding in a gentler voice that he never wanted the incident mentioned again.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think this actually ties into our previous discussions of the two thought systems we all have. We all have this 100% sane self that is the love that you so appropriately suggest that we return to.
Yes.
And then there's this crazy, selfish, individual, I'm doing it my own way.
Right.
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Right. Ego.
It's the ego, basically.
It is. Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's the crazy part of us that if we take its maxims and its slogans to heart, we get as crazy and as pale as Napoleon. And I think my experience, having been in that same chamber in the fall of 92 with 21 people in our group that was led by a fellow named Greg Braden, who some of your listeners might be familiar with.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, really, really wonderful person. And he gave us this great tour up and down the Nile, and we had some time to go in what's called the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
And there's a depiction on the next page, on page 50, of Napoleon in the King's Chamber. In the Tompkins book, with all their torches lit. Of course, they didn't have flashlights then. All the, you know, the locals watching over him.
Right.
So that's why actually you'll see, you know, sort of soot on the ceiling of these chambers, because you know, centuries of people going in there with torches, and so it's
wow.
It's not exactly what you call a good housekeeping approved location, but it's a fascinating place to visit. By golly,
that's amazing.
But I think what my experience was, and I think several other people that I've heard accounts from, was that it's a resonating device, and the electromagnetic frequencies that are channeled, harnessed, focused,
yes,
whatever you want to call it there,
yes,
about one-third of the altitude up from the center of the pyramid's base, in this what's called a king's chamber, there's this granite box. And we all took turns, all 21 of us, laying down in this granite box. And I don't know if I mentioned this on prior show, but when I just thought, well, I'm going to see what my voice sounds like, and I started toning.
Yes.
And within a split second, I found a resonant frequency that resonated not only with the resonant frequencies of the box, which synchronistic, interestingly, have a 2-4 square root of 5 relationship.
1.6 or 1.168?
Yeah, well,
or is that
the square root of 5 is a factor in the formula for the golden ratio.
Oh, okay.
So it all ties together. So, but the square root of 5 and added plus 1 divided by 2 is the golden ratio.
Okay. I see. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's fascinating that you know, here you've got a resonant structure that has a second harmonic and a square root of 5 over 2 over harmonic built into it. And then the King's Chamber itself has similar geometries. What's called the King's Chamber? I just call it the uppermost, you know, publicly accessible chamber, because it kind of implies that it was a pharaoh's burial tomb.
Okay.
And the probably the biggest argument against that is the conventional Egyptological theory is that the pharaohs were put in their sarcophagi, which is plural for sarcophagus.
Yeah, yes. Of course.
And then you know, with really muscular dudes, you know, hauled into the, you know, in situ, in, you know, into their burial chambers. And well, the only fly in the ointment of that theory is that the passageway that goes into the antechamber, as it's called, and then what's called the king's chamber, is too small for that sarcophagus, quote unquote, wow, that granite box to fit through. So basically, they would have had to just drag the corpse in there, because the granite box was either built in, you know, the pyramid was either built around that granite box, or somehow somebody, you know, transported it in there a la Star Trek or something.
Wow.
Because it had to be in there when the structure was built.
Right. So, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's like if you've ever read any of Douglas Adams' books, there's this one of his where he tries to get a couch upstairs and discovers mathematically that it was impossible and it got stuck in the stairwell.
You know what? I have heard of that before.
So the same kind of thing. You know, the granite box that they call a sarcophagus is built into the room that they call the king's chamber in what's called, you know, they call the Cheops pyramid, but I think that's kind of like calling the Great Pyramid, or, you know, the White House calling it the Bush House or the Obama House. You know, it's like, well, yeah, those guys might have lived there, but, you know, it might have been a more general term for the structure, you know.
Right. Kind of
So whenever anyone calls it the Cheops or Khufu Pyramid, I say, well, how about just calling it the Great Pyramid? Because, you know, it from the research of people like John Anthony West and his geologist friend Robert Schock, if that's any indication, that complex may be quite a bit older. I think – I don't know if I mentioned that on a prior
yes,
session we've done. That he when we were in Egypt in the fall of 92, we had the good pleasure and fortune of talking with – in addition to Greg Braden's group, we ran into John Anthony West, who was a rogue Egyptologist, and I think he's still around. And anyway, he gave a talk to us on the Mena House Hotel lawn one evening and explained how he, just in the last year or two at that time, had done a little trick, and he had masked off a photo of the hindquarters of the Sphinx. and the Great Sphinx, which is, you know, the one that everybody knows about, right, next to the three big pyramids there, and the other six smaller ones on the Giza Plateau. And the trick that he did is he masked it off in such a way that you could see the edge of one of the surfaces of the Sphinx, but you couldn't really tell what it was. I mean, it could have just been, you know, the side of an old temple or something like that, or just a side of a hillside. It really was nondescript enough that you really couldn't tell exactly what it was, but you could tell from the photo, because it was a close-up of what kind of erosion, and for those who had eyes to see that. And this geologist named Robert Schock was just such a person. And so what John Anthony West did is he masked off the photo, handed it to Schock, and said, okay, what do you attribute, you know, the weathering, trying to, you know, not lead him in any direction, you know, to. And he said, well, this is evidence of many millennia of water erosion.
Wow. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Please go on. But I know where this is going.
But then what that means is that since the Great Pyramid and the Giza Complex and the Sphinx in particular haven't had that kind of weather. I mean, actually, I think it was like a year or two ago that there was actually snow in Cairo, and like first time in centuries or something like that, you know, hundreds of years, or at least many, many decades. So they don't get much precipitation there. I mean, this is, you know, high desert, well, not high, but, you know, desert country, right?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, even the meteorological records that most people would go with would suggest that Egypt has been a really, really dry, arid place.
Absolutely.
For a long time.
Long time.
So there hasn't been that kind of, you know, rampant water erosion capabilities in that area for a long time. Wow. So what that implies is that either, you know, somebody's got their wires crossed, or maybe the pyramid's a whole lot older, and the Sphinx, you know, a whole lot older. No, that kind of presupposes that they were built about the same time, but more than likely, I would think. And some of the dating, the carbon dating and different things that I've read about the Great Pyramid, including in the Tompkins book, suggest that it might be quite a bit older than the dynastic Egypt that we're familiar with.
That's amazing. So, yeah. I do know that we've spoken about this briefly before. Now, there is mention of a great flood, right?
Right.
Is this kind of where we're headed a little bit? Is this the
direction? Well, interestingly enough, you know, Plato, since we seem to keep coming back to one of our patron saints, if you will, of sacred geometry.
Yes, indeed.
He wrote a book or a treatise called the Timaeus, which I remember reading in high school shortly after I kind of found out about this in the Tompkins book, I believe. In the Timaeus, Plato describes the Great Flood and Atlantis and all that kind of stuff. And then there's been archaeological and
evidence,
you know, scuba expeditions that suggest that, well, you know, maybe there was something to all that.
Yes.
maybe there's a cyclic happening that's going on, and, you know, we build up civilizations to a point, and then we get stupid and do dumb things, and now we have to start over, and maybe we're back at that point again. In fact, on I think it's on my brucerawls.com website. I've got a photo of a lintel, which is a giant stone header in the Temple of Abydos, Egypt.
Wow.
And let's see if I can find it real quick.
I'll pull it up too.
Yeah.
Everyone, let's hop on brucerawls.com.
If you type brucerawls.com and then Abydos, I think you'll find it. That's what I'm looking for right now. And there it is. Yeah. So there's this I see some of the photos, and there's this other people who have taken pictures of this. But basically, if you see the image that I'm looking at, you'll see something in the upper left that looks remarkably like a helicopter, and other shapes that look like submarines and jet aircraft and that sort of thing. But these were chiseled thousands of years ago.
Wow!
In the 15, 18, whatever it is, feet above the floor of this Ptolemaic temple in Abydos, Egypt.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, well, what did they know? Or were they just lucky guesses, and this was their form of sci-fi, you know, fantasy of what the future might be?
Wow.
Well, maybe, but what was interesting is one of the guys that was on our trip in 92 knew a – I'm not sure if he was – what branch of the service he was in. But he was good buddies with somebody who was fairly high up in the military. And when he showed the photo that he had taken, just like the one you'll find if you Google that.
Yes, I'm looking at it right now. This is amazing.
He said, oh, how did you get this? That, you know, one of these craft is top secret military classified.
Right.
So anyway, and that's all I heard. So you're getting this like third or fourth hand now. So,
but
I thought
amazing.
That was kind of an interesting anecdote.
But what it
hints at is that not only is – are the pyramids older and more sophisticated than are generally assumed, but that maybe there's a technology in our minds that is far more advanced than we give ourselves credit for.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the more important story, which ties into the Hermetic laws and particularly the law of mentalism. And Hermes Trismegistus, who is one associated with the Hermetic laws and as the author, is also reported to in some lore such as the Emerald Tablets of Thoth to be the architect of the Great Pyramid. I think I've got that right. Anyway,
wow.
some document I read years ago suggests that Hermes Trismegistus, who's responsible for the Hermetic philosophy and these laws that I wrote the second book about in part, was the architect not only of the Great Pyramid, but of sciences such as chemistry and astronomy and a whole bunch of other stuff, and
wow.
mathematics and writing, and certainly the Thoth pseudonym or whatever you call his alternate name
right.
was responsible for you know, this, the art of writing and recording things, you know, so that we have a record.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the pyramid is an amazing record. There's not only the geology of the pyramid is fascinating, because it sits on – if you take a line going through the center of the Great Pyramid, a latitude line going to the North Pole and then one to the South Pole, it's almost exactly on the 30th parallel above the equator.
Wow.
If you add up all the landmass above that parallel, it is exactly the same as the landmass below that parallel.
No
and if, it
way.
Kind of makes sense, because if you look at North America, South America, Europe, Africa, and Asia, most of it's above the equator. And there's someone who you know did the calculations, and apparently fairly accurately that works out. Same thing if you take a great circle line and wrap it around the North Pole, the South Pole, in such a way that it passes through the center of the Great Pyramid, the land mass east and west is equal as well.
Yes. That's
amazing.
And then
if you take into account the flattening of the poles, that the Earth is actually a spheroid, not a sphere, a true sphere, because of relativistic effects and gravity and so forth, it's actually like, you know, a little like Christmas indulgent chubby around the midriff there.
Exactly.
So that our equator actually is a little bit bigger around than any of the great circles that pass through the North or South Pole. So because it's a spheroid and slightly flattened into the poles longer at the equator, if you take into account the Earth's spheroidal shape, not the spherical shape, it's truly a spheroid,
right.
Which you only can only was discovered from outer space, you know, with the space program photography and analyses, from what I understand. Then the spheroidal shape places the Great Pyramid's apex at exactly the 30th parallel.
Wow!
Above the equator of a spheroid.
That's amazing.
Not a sphere.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then the ascending passageway, which is the main one that you go down into the structure of the pyramid, just happens to be perfectly aligned with the north, you know, with the polar axis. So that if you're at the bottom of that, and if there's not too much light, ambient light, you can see the North Star any time of night or day.
Wow.
And it's in the Tompkins book, and it's been a long time since I've kind of looked this up again, but I seem to recall that the first 50 feet of that descending passageway, or ascending, depending on how you look at it, whether you're going in or out,
right,
but it slopes down into the pyramid as you go into it.
Wow.
The first 50 feet was so accurately cut.
That's amazing.
That they had to use a laser to measure the accuracy.
That's amazing. Okay, so see that kind of stuff.
And then the the structure itself, over 13.1 acres,
okay,
is level to within a half an inch.
Wow.
Can you imagine doing that on a structure,
wow,
that has 2.6 million?
That's insane.
Very, very precisely cut stones.
That's
polished granite and limestone, and have it being accurate within a half inch over 13 acres. Yeah, and it's like 480 feet tall, which is like a 48-story building.
That's
but
amazing.
Like most 48-story buildings, it's wide. It's 760 feet roughly on a side.
Wow.
And that – I mean, when we were driving around Cairo, when we first landed there, and we stayed at one of the hotels with a swimming pool, and we were several miles away from it. But the Giza complex, those three pyramids, particularly the first two, which are roughly the same height, the second one's just a slightly bit lower, but it sits on higher ground. They tower above the Cairo landscape. I mean, you're driving around, and everywhere you look out of the corner of your eye, there's those two giant pyramids. I mean,
wow,
that's just huge.
That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
It's just there's all kinds of interesting phenomena. I think in previous shows we talked about the geometry of the shape having the pi and phi proportions, because it's basically a flat representation of a hemisphere. The cartographer Mercator was able to go into the pyramid, and he from that was able to make a flat representation of the Earth, because the four faces of the pyramid essentially create a perfect geometry for mapping a hemisphere. So that's how Mercator was able to preserve the shapes and the areas. And I forget which is which. There's different projections that preserve different qualities.
That is absolutely amazing.
So
Bruce,
it encodes the number pi, because the circumference of the pyramid, which is a square base relative to its altitude, is 2 pi, just as the circumference of a hemisphere is 2 pi relative to its altitude. And
that's
then the
amazing
phi proportion, the golden ratio, is encoded in what's called the apothem, which is the line that runs down the middle of any of the four faces and hits the midpoint of any of the base sides. And then that half a base side is the other part of that proportion.
That is so amazing, Bruce. We actually, Bruce, my brother, we are out of time. I'm so sorry. We are crunched. We are crunched. I want to send my unconditional love and appreciation to you, Bruce. I want to tell everybody to check out geometrycode.com and Bruce Rawls. That's RAWLES.com. All my love and appreciation to you, Bruce. Make sure to check out.
Thank you, David. Have a wonderful holiday and happy solstice to everyone in about a little over an hour.
Yes, and happy solstice. Happy solstice here on the High Vibration Station, always sending out our high vibrations. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Good Vibe Station. I love each and every single one of you. We will see you next Sunday. Thank you so much, Bruce. Always love, light, and appreciation from our hearts to yours. We'll talk to you next Sunday, my friend. See you guys soon.
Watch me nod out. Just injected this vibration into the collective. That's what we're about. Never neglected. WMDT.